There are men and women who are walking the point for the armed forces that are there in Iraq and Afghanistan that are neither regular U.S. Army or Marines or Navy or Air Force. They're private contractors. And in many cases, they are put in the most dangerous situations. Fallujah is one of those cases we'll talk about coming up in just a second. But we'll also explore the domestic use of private security, that is to say, where Blackwater and Triple Canopy and some of these other organizations fit in our national security here on these shores. And we'll talk about the lack of accountability for Blackwater and what that means about the kind of person that it attracts, plus the big money rewards that exist for those that survive. Next, the book is License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror, Robert Young Pelton on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Over the Thanksgiving holiday, Robert Young Pelton, I was talking with my uncle who served in World War II under Patton, foot soldier, killed a lot of people, didn't enjoy it. So it was easy for him to sort of, you know, get back into society. He had no particular jones for being in war. He did what he was asked to do for his country, did it because he was trying to, you know, secure freedom for Europe and for the United States to end the tyranny of Adolf Hitler, and felt this higher cause, you know, shot, was a good aim, you know, was it killed, took out his share of enemy soldiers, but never missed it, never talked about wanting to go back. And I was thinking about him a little bit while I was reading the book, License to Kill, because it seems like many of the people that you write about kind of miss being not just in the action of a firefight, but being able to kill people. I mean, they sort of get something out of that.
Well, you mentioned an interesting concept that a lot of people have forgotten about, and that's the citizen soldier. And a lot of people might say that the foundation of a democracy is in the citizen soldier, someone who puts down his tools and then joins the army, defends the country, then comes back and goes back to whatever trade or whatever occupation he had before, because war is a distasteful, ugly thing. Then you transition into what they call the all-volunteer army, and then the next level above that is essentially the mercenary army, and this actually goes back in time to what they used to call professional soldiers.
Sure.
Most people were farmers and sailors or whatever. They didn't know how to use a longbow or how to wield a broad axe or whatever, so they used to hire professional soldiers to defend city-states in Europe and things like that. It's only fairly recently that the control of the army or violence or the professional soldier has always been under the control of the state, and we've created a very, very highly technical, very demanding form of warfare. For example, when you fly a UAV that's got missiles on it, you don't just have a soldier that gets up in the morning and do that. You have an entire operation that does that. That leaves a huge arena open for the privatized sector to say, we can do that cheaper. We can take the same guys you trained to do this. We can rent them back to you on a short-term basis, and we can fight wars cheaper than you do. Now, when we talk about these companies like DynCorp, like Triple Canopy, like Blackwater, they're not offering to fight wars. They're not saying we're going to go out there and take over this country and send you a bill. What they are is part of the war effort. And the war effort today is actually equal citizen sort of contractors. There's about 180,000 contractors, not just security contractors, but contractors, and about 160,000 soldiers in Iraq. So to fight wars today, we need a citizen or a private capability.
Yeah, but there's a psychology to some of these folks that you interview in the book, and God bless them for being willing to be so open with you and for your attitude and not judging them to their face or making them uncomfortable that they held back their points of view.
Right.
Because judging by what you write here, these guys, they like it. I mean, they like being able to fire at other people. They're not bothered by... Seemingly, they're not bothered terribly by collateral damage, and they know that the bottom line is they're going to get their new boat, they're going to get their college funds for their kids taken care of. They're in it for their money,
right,
not for necessarily a higher patriotic cause. And you know, it's kind of fun for them.
Well, in my perspective, I just laid out the good side of the argument. In other words, when you talked about the citizen soldier, there's someone that has a hatred for war, distaste for that activity. Now you have the professional soldier, and then you have the mercenary. In other words, you have guys who work for Blackwater, guys I've spent time with, who have a list of confirmed kills, who can tell you with great detail how they took out an Iraqi and what kind of ammunition they used, what kind of scope they used, what kind of gear they were wearing at the time. And they talk about it as if they're deer hunting. And these are guys that when they come back to the States are bored out of their minds. And
yeah.
They're just waiting to get back to Afghanistan or back to Iraq. And that lack of accountability, that sort of, you know, the Wyatt Earp kind of Wild West mentality that they carry with them, is it evidence when you talk to Iraqis, when you drive down the street? For example, I move around Iraq, you know, with locals, and I drive in a beat-up old taxi. When these security convoys come at you, you are looking at what is the most frightening thing on this planet, a group of guys that can blow you away in a heartbeat, and they don't even stop, let alone worry if they kill somebody.
Well, I guess that's what I'm getting at, and I appreciate the position you're in, but I will say it's in many guys' cases, they don't seem morally conflicted at all about what they're doing. They couldn't give a flip. They're told this is okay, so they do it, and, you know, they're for them, it's another day at the office, and, you know, I get the feeling that they kind of scratches some deep itch, which they rather enjoy.
But here's the thing that you have to, and here's what the readers always have to remember. They always work for someone. These guys aren't over in Iraq by themselves. And if you remember the September 16th shooting in Fidro Square, Nero Square, with Blackwater defending State Department employees, the decision to make the shoot was given by a State Department employee. The way that Blackwater dresses, the vehicles they drive, the weapons they use, are all defined by the U.S. State Department. The fact that our diplomats have to travel around in a war zone and be protected by a dozen guys is a decision that our government has made. And
okay.
That's really the part you have to also remember.
Of course. Well, I don't mean to belabor that point. So let's. I guess that would bring us to a discussion of Fallujah and how it is that got very complicated for Blackwater and for the United States, not to mention the victims.
Yeah, I think most people, when we started the war in Iraq, had an understanding there was a contractor presence. You know, we had what they call LOGCAP, which is the civilian component that supports military activity. And we think of those people as truck drivers, people who clean toilets, run the chow halls and things like that. I think most Americans didn't have a problem with that because we expected the civilian component to support our troops overseas, and it was going to be a short war, and it's better that we hire this out and get it done and come home. In 2003, the late 2003, the insurgency started to take off, and by 2004 it was in full swing, and there was a point at which a decision was made to rebuild Iraq, which means a lot of civilian companies and contractors were working over there, while we were actively fighting a war, and this required a huge security component. And Blackwater had their first commercial contract working for a German sort of caterer who would provide food for the troops. And they had just taken over this job from Control Risk, which is an English company. And their job was to essentially learn the routes, figure out what was safe, what wasn't safe. But, you know, Eric Prince, who's the owner of Blackwater, has a very, very aggressive stance in how he does business. So he wanted to show the client that he was going to be out there and help these people. So they had to pick up some pots and pans at one military base and take it to another military base. And I'm literally, these are three empty trucks going to pick up a bunch of kitchen equipment so that somebody can, you know, stock a kitchen. He decides to send a crew of guys there, but they're short because one guy missed a plane, and that's actually T-Boy, the fellow I mentioned in the early part of this conversation, missed his plane, and so they sent a Navy SEAL, a guy named Scott Helvinson, up to Baghdad to round out this component of security. Now, if you understand how a PSD works, which is a personal security detail, you have to have at least one vehicle, more likely to have three vehicles. And that's because you have to look in front of you, you have to look behind you, and if you get into trouble, you need another vehicle to get into. So what happened is because they were short on manpower and they were eager to do things, they sent out two vehicles, which at that time were Mitsubishi Pajeros, which were used by the CIA. They were in sort of common supply, and armored vehicles were in short supply. In this particular contract, the armored vehicles were supposed to be supplied by the client, and the client didn't do that. And they sent out only four people, and that's two men in each vehicle. Now, if you can imagine, if you're driving and there's someone sitting next to you, you're not spending a lot of time looking behind you, and you're probably covering your first 180-degree, and then the guy behind you is hopefully looking behind you. They decide to head out, and because there's some animosity within the company, the team manager refuses to give this group maps. Now, you have to remember that Fallujah is not very far from Baghdad. It's about a good, you know, two-hour drive. And their job was to go there, meet these trucks, pick this stuff up, come back. Well, they got lost. And they spent the night at a military base. They started asking people how to get here, how to get there. And whatever security they had or whatever sort of covertness for their mission was gone. And they were driving around Fallujah, and at that time Fallujah was a very dangerous place, and even the military didn't go through Fallujah. They stopped, they met an Iraqi civilian patrol. He said, oh yeah, we can take you to the base, we'll just cut right through Fallujah. They got into traffic, and all of a sudden the escort they had just bolted and took off. Insurgents ran from behind an alleyway, killed two of the men instantly. The other two who were in the front turned around and tried to come to the rescue of the first two that were killed, and they were shot dead instantly. And then these bodies were taken out of the vehicles after they were burned and hung from a bridge. Now, that's not an unusual scenario in a war, but two things happened that made it very, very important. One is that this was videotaped, and that tape went around the world, and it looked exactly like Black Hawk Down. The second thing is that we had a Hearts and Mind campaign in Fallujah, which was basically hands-off, handle it with kids' gloves. We then shifted, and when we say we, I mean President Bush, ordered to go into Fallujah and find the people who did this, and we ended up flattening Fallujah, which created one of the most seminal moments in the war in Iraq. So we actually changed our military tactics and strategy because of this one incident, because four civilians got lost in the most dangerous city in Iraq. And I think that's when Blackwater and civilian contractors first hit the map.
Now, there seemed to be a pattern, though, up until this point, of a disconnect between the U.S. governmental policy and the actions of these private security details, in that they wanted the plausible deniability for their actions, and kind of like how we think maybe about how special operatives work, the feeling was if you get captured, if you get killed, it's not like your regular army. You can't necessarily expect that the army is going to go back in and save you because you're a private security guy. What happened that was different in Fallujah on that?
Well, Fallujah was a screw-up. It was a commercial contract that was undermanned, that the client was supposed to provide protective equipment and didn't. It was an attempt by a private corporation to show another private corporation that they were on the job, they were going to do the right thing, they were going to protect this convoy. And it happened to be at a time at which, 2 months before, you know, the insurgency wasn't as violent as it was in the spring of that time. And these people happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time, but they were there because of incompetence. In other words, had they done a safety check, had they done what they call an advance, which is, you know, scouting the route first and then coming back and doing a map and an alternative route, they wouldn't have done that. And it was basically sloppiness. And four people died. Now, if it were soldiers, now at the same day, a number of soldiers were blown up by an IED, but when those soldiers died, it didn't shift the whole focus of the war. It was the fact that these were civilians and it was very visible on TV that made our president change the way we fought the war.
But it shouldn't be the other way around. The fact that these were civilian contractors, these were soldiers for hire, mm-hmm. Why would that shift? It wasn't like they, you know, they captured like four people who were, as you said earlier, cleaning toilets or something and tortured them. That would be different somehow. But these are, they screwed up. They were heavily armed. They got lost. They got killed. I don't want to say.
Well, you have to remember, there is actually a manual called Contractors on the Battlefield. I mean, the military, our military is probably the most intelligent, well-researched military there is. They've thought this through, and they have made a decision at that point that civilians are not to be forward of the combat area. In other words, they're supposed to be back you know, when you clean a latrine, you don't do it on the front lines, you do it
right
back in the base. When you put civilians in an armed capacity in what would essentially be the front lines, in other words, the most dangerous place in Fallujah, there's problems because of that. In other words, they don't have air support. They don't even have radio communications. They can't even call the military to tell them what they're doing. So you're going to have a number of problems. And don't forget, at that time, they were kidnapping and murdering a number of civilians.
Sure.
And they were targeting civilian contractors because they felt they were part of the war effort. So what had happened was our sort of sense of let's get this war over with, or let's make money, or let's do this, got ahead of our strategy. And we hadn't actually planned for what happens if civilians start dying. And as to date, I think over 1,000 contractors have been killed in Iraq. And there's still no accurate count of how many are either working over there or how many have died or being injured while working over there.
Right.
So there's no plan for this. This just sort of mushroomed.
All right. So what happens in Fallujah that eventually turns into what Fallujah became?
Well, the interesting thing, I mean, I travel around the world, and not just this war, but I mean, in many other wars. Fallujah was viewed as one of those seminal events in which the West basically slaughtered, razed an entire city, and killed thousands of innocents. And there were actually Somali mujahideen wearing Fallujah T-shirts after this event. And it galvanized the Iraqis from thinking that they were being liberated to sort of parallels with the Jenin and the destruction of the camps by Israelis. So what happened is that it shifted the idea that we're here to save you or we're here to liberate you to mercenaries coming over and killing us. And that, I mean, in terms of, you have to be in Baghdad to understand it, but we were now viewed as no better than occupiers or crusaders or mercenaries.
Right. Well, I think we can understand that without being in Baghdad, that it got worse. Now, what changed, though? And Blackwater has obviously been in trouble. It's gotten a high amount of scrutiny, and they were able to keep some of these details from hitting the press for a long time before Blackwater did.
But actually, there is a lawsuit, and what happened is that the families were shocked. I mean, these gentlemen had told their families they're going off and working security and so on and so forth. There's no never under understanding they would be murdered and killed that brutally. And when they wanted to get redress from the corporation, which is Blackwater, initially they were very helpful. I mean, Blackwater takes very good care of its employees. But then when they wanted more and more, they were basically shut off. So then they hired a lawyer, and the lawyer's been going after Blackwater. And probably the single most damaging lawsuit I've seen in a long time, in which they've been driving the bus in terms of the public image of Blackwater. But more importantly, people started to say, who are these people? Like, why are we hiring civilians to be in combat? Now, in other words, why are men running around with guns getting murdered when we have the military over there? And what had happened is that two things. One is that this administration had set up a very aggressive, forward-leaning foreign policy, which means that we are going to operate in Iraq under extremely violent conditions, and we're going to hire civilians to allow corporations and diplomats to get around. And secondly, we don't care what the locals think, because you have to remember the other side effect of Fallujah was that these security companies got extremely aggressive. In other words, they converted immediately not only to armored cars, but to almost tank-like vehicles, and gunning up with heavy machine guns, you know, M4s,
sure,
and then raising the rules of violence to levels that you wouldn't even see in Somalia.
Well, we'll leave the rest of the discussion of Fallujah to readers of the book, License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror. There's a lot in there, and yet more still coming out about just what went wrong with the private security details that are there in Iraq. But when we come back with Robert Young Pelton, I want to pick up on the thread we spun out earlier. What is Blackwater's role in domestic security? And what's the future of that next on Coast to Coast AM? This is Ian Punnett. Good old Andy Griffith. There's a reason why we're playing that hymn, not just because it's one of my favorites, but because it pertains directly to a discussion we're having about Blackwater and Triple Canopy and these other private security defense contractors, these people that provide the auxiliary firepower, the, in many cases, unregulated firepower of our forces in Afghanistan and in Iraq. They have little accountability. They have high profitability. And they are doing a lot of the heavy lifting for the U.S. political interests in these two countries in the war on terror. So why are they licensed to kill these hired guns in the war on terror? We'll talk more about what it means for us domestically in just a moment. I'm broadcasting from the studios of WFLA in Orlando. I'd like to thank David Bogensky again for being my contact here. Although I have to say, I went looking around here for a men's room and I couldn't find one. I don't know where the guys on this floor go, so I had to use the ladies' room, and I felt a little bit like I was in enemy territory for just a moment. Nobody tell on Monday morning. And when we come back, we'll talk about what some of the things that have happened in enemy territory with these private contractors that couldn't happen with the regular armed forces that are there right now on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Talking with our guest, Robert Young Pelton. I played Onward Christian Soldiers before because I was caught by that piece I've seen on the internet and a couple other places. People have sent it to me in the email this week about how Eric Prince and some of the recruiters of Blackwater specifically are interested in people who are born-again Christians or Mormons. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, this is a myth that's come out of Jeremy Scahill's book that the major motivation behind Eric Prince is a sense of religion or religious entitlement. And Eric's father was a well-known industrialist from Holland, Michigan. And his father had a heart attack in the, I guess it means around 70 years old. And he became an absolutely right-wing, hardcore Christian fundamentalist, right-to-life kind of fellow, and set up a number of foundations. And when he died in the mid-90s, Eric still donates to a number of his charities, mostly because his mother is still alive, and he runs those businesses and takes care of those charities. But Eric actually is a libertarian and a Roman Catholic, and he's hired a number of, I'd say, right-wing people, but I think more because of the business requirements. In other words, he's operating in a sort of a right-wing neocon world right now. And, I've known Eric. I've talked to him, interviewed him, been to social functions with him. And he is a family man, and he does go to church on Sunday, but he is not what Jeremy Scahill paints him to be. Now, saying that, there is a component within the special forces community, within the military, that is religious, and I don't think that's a bad thing. I don't think people should be criticized because they have a belief in some religion, but it does tend to color the sort of patriotism and the sense of combination of, religion, duty, military. And in the private sector, that can be a little disturbing sometimes.
Yeah, I think that's part of the interesting. So, well, let me back up for a second. So then is it a myth then that a criterion that they are interested in, that they would look for, a characteristic of a potential recruit might be that they're a born-again Christian or a Mormon? Was somehow...
You're probably thinking of the CIA.
Well,
the
what I saw...
Mormons and looks for people with good, strong religious backgrounds. But the bottom line is there's nothing on your application form at Blackwater that asks you how religious you are.
Okay, and it wasn't so much about so religious. I just wondered whether they were looking at that as sort of indicative of whether or not you saw things sort of black and white, good guys, bad guys,
good versus evil. No, this is a myth that's really tied into, Jeremy Scahill has done very well with his book called Blackwater, but this is a political sort of hijack of what's really going on. I mean, the privatization of violence has been going on through multiple, administrations, and then the first major, most robust use was under the Clinton administration. Let's say the Republicans are out, the Democrats are back in, all these companies are going to function. They're not going to vanish magically because all of a sudden there's a Democrat in the White House.
No, don't.
People have to remember.
Oh, don't get me wrong. I'm not like Michael Vick. I don't have a dog in this fight. I'm just curious because that sort of fit at least a stereotype that seems to come through in some of these interviews, and that seems to be that there's very few people who are interested in moral ambiguity. with whom you speak. And there's that one guy you interview, and he seems like he's a little bit more reflective than some of the other fellows. Hart, is that his name? No.
Well, Hart is the English company, and there's no religious affiliation there.
No. Who's the guy that was an accountant, and he was kind of a little bit more...
Oh, Michael Grunberg, who runs Danline. I mean, he is the most apolitical, a-religious person I know. Right. His father was a Jewish tailor in London. I mean, there's no connection there to any right wing.
Well, no, that's what I mean, though. I mean, with him as being an exception, he seems sort of reflective and seemed sort of... wondering, and then you have that guy Lamont in the book License to Kill, who actually sort of wondered whether or not he was supporting the cause that he was fighting for, paid to fight for. But that a lot of the other guys, they didn't really care. They were just perfectly happy to be told those are the bad guys, go kill them.
The mercenary calling, and this is something that's fascinating to me, is that when you come out of the military, you have a skill set.
Right.
The question is mindset. What do you use those skills to do?
Right.
And I document in my book people who work as security contractors tell their boss they're going buffalo hunting in South Africa and end up being arrested trying to overthrow a country.
Right.
In other words, you can function as a mercenary, you can function as a cop, and you can function as a soldier because you have the skill sets for it. So the real key is, what is the moral linkage? What is the thing that chains these people down? So, you know, when you're mentioning, like, don't these guys go over there and like to shoot people and this and that? Yes, there are some people that do this. As a matter of fact, there was a great story about a Triple Canopy employee who was leaving Iraq and said, hey, I want to shoot somebody before I get on the plane. And he tried twice to take out Iraqis who were just driving down the street. There are people like that. But there's also people that have never pulled the trigger on their gun, even if they're being fired at, because they're seasoned professionals and they don't do that. So, but is there opportunity for abuse? Absolutely.
Right. So that makes us then happy. I'm glad I played that song and glad you cleared that up, or at least helped to flesh that out a little bit more. Where are we back to where we were an hour ago on this idea that Blackwater and other private security firms are involved domestically in our security in the United States?
Well, this is something that has been under the surface. Because you can imagine if you spent 20 years in the special operations area and you'd been well-trained by our government to detect terrorism, to protect nuclear facilities, to, you know, jump out of aircraft and swim underwater, you're really not that hireable once you get out. So you end up working in the security industry. Now, Eric Prince's initial goal was to set up a training facility, but as it evolved, he became infatuated with the idea of peacekeeping in sort of African nations. And when Hurricane Katrina hit, he was working with the Coast Guard, working on a training program, and he immediately told his helicopter to turn around, go back there, and start rescuing people. Well, the Coast Guard said, hey, you can't do that. You can't fly a helicopter around and pick people off of roofs, but why don't you come down and help us with some other things? So when folks from Blackwater landed, a lot of the wealthy homeowners said, hey, I got an art collection in my house. Can you send a bunch of guys over there to guard it? Now, a fascinating event occurred during that time in which the New Orleans police is reputed to have vanished or not been able to get to work. But friends of mine were working for Blackwater, guarding a wealthy person's house. And one night, a van pulled up with guys with ski masks and a gunfight erupted. The guys in the van were cops who were going around looting all the wealthy people's homes because they knew exactly where the good stuff was. So essentially you had a shootout between Blackwater security and the police in New Orleans who were acting as criminals. And then what happened, people said, well, we need more of these guys. So eventually they had about 350 Blackwater employees down there. They worked with SBC to guard the trucks so they wouldn't get stolen. They guarded hotels. One of the more fascinating things was they were hired to guard FEMA from American citizens. In other words, irate people who were angry at FEMA for not giving them something were then told by Blackwater to back off and stay away. So what should have been a peacekeeping mission essentially became protection for rich folks and the government against the people of America.
That's a scary pattern.
To me, it's fascinating because, you know, it's like a Petri dish. I mean, the war in Iraq and Hurricane Katrina are things born out of chaos and things grow out of it, these sort of Frankenstein ideas that the U.S. government would actually hire private security to protect them from citizens, to me, is a devastating concept.
Well, and I'm with you to a point. I mean, to me, my son's Nikes are a Petri dish. This to me is a, this is more like some vial of some plague that's being right now contained that could, if it broke out, it could really be devastating. And I wonder whether if there's a pattern to this that we don't need to be concerned about.
Well,
the same
trajectory here. I mean,
yeah.
I travel. I've been to over 100 and some odd countries. I stopped counting. And I go to some of the worst places on Earth, and I look at how things work there. And what I see is the future. Most countries like Colombia, Nigeria, have an infrastructure and a wealthy class that's guarded by private security. You know, the oil depots, the private homes, the luxury estates, the politicians are all guarded by private guards. And the rest of the country is left to fend for itself with a very corrupt, inept police force. And I see the world changing that way. In other words, if you live in a wealthy suburb like Beverly Hills, you don't rely on the Beverly Hills Police Department. You have a private security company that comes to your rescue. And the government is moving the same way. They go towards private security for nuclear facilities, embassies, things like that.
Well, let me push it a little bit differently, though, after having read your book. I mean, what I know is that our government uses these private security firms to sidestep their own laws, that we've created laws that restrict the movements or the actions of our armed forces, so we will fill in the gaps between what we can do and what we want to do by hiring private security firms. And I wonder whether that isn't the same pattern that would be used here against the people of the United States. We have laws that prevent the use, say, of military and other things against our own people. Could we be hiring these details to come out and do the things which our government wants to do, which they're prevented from doing legally?
Well, it's already happened. I mean, people with training in the security industry, whether in the police or the military, transition into the private sector and offer the same services in a very low-key but high-priced commodity. For example, if I was suspicious about you and I wanted to find out things about you, I wouldn't go to the government and say, can I have all this information? I would go to a private company who would give me your phone number, your address, your credit history, whether you'd had any, you know, arrests or convictions, what you did at night, where you went. They'd put a GPS thing on your car and tell me where you went, who you visited. That's all for the private sector now. And as you know, our government actually went to private corporations to get information on our cell phone conversations and where approximately the call was made from and at what time. So we've already passed that line where private industry is now providing the tools our government uses to surveil us with.
God, I wish I were that interesting.
Well, you may not.
I wish there were anything that anybody could find.
You know, you can buy your neighbor's cell phone records and figure out, you know, where he lives and who he calls. And that's all through the private sector.
Mm-hmm. My life is so transparent that there's just nothing to find. I wish there were. So let's talk about the current state of Blackwater, because they were kind of in hot Blackwater there for a while, weren't they?
Yeah. Well, Blackwater, obviously, Eric Prince is a very affluent man. When his father died, he left a large amount of money. They sold his father's company for $1.3 billion, and it was split up between his sisters and his mother and himself. So he has enough operating capital to do anything he wants. So he became very aggressive in developing ideas, concepts, and courting both State Department, which is CIA and State Department, as well as private sector business. He managed to get almost all the State Department business for Iraq until September 16th, in which there was a shootout in which 11, depending on who you believe, about a dozen Iraqis killed, and the State Department hung him out to dry. And for the first time, he suddenly realized that the government was his enemy, that all this work and effort he put in, all this patriotism, all this sort of not making a big profit, didn't seem to matter because the State Department was more interested in covering their own tracks that led to this shootout than to defending a private corporation. And then you see the 60s returning again. And you remember that story about Billy Waugh working for Ed Wilson in Libya, being hired to train Gaddafi's special forces, thinking it was a CIA job. And then the CIA comes to him and said, oh, if you're over there, take some pictures. We'll pay you money for them. And suddenly realizing that Ed Wilson was running a rogue operation, and he went to jail, And then Ed Wilson magically gets vindicated years later for actually working for the CIA. You're seeing the same thing now with Blackwater, where our government is hanging them out to dry.
And yet, could it be because, like any other contractor, the government had conveyed to them, whether in text or subtext, do not do X, and Blackwater, as the standards were lowered, I'm going to say that again, and I again, you can correct me if you'd like. But
no, you hit it right on the head, because okay. There's two components of State Department security. There's what they call DSS, the Department of State, or Diplomatic Security Services, and then there's the hired guns, and these are the Blackwaters, the Triple Canopies, and the DynCorp elements that work under the WPPS contract, the Worldwide Protective Services. Previously, DynCorp had that business, and they clashed with the RSO, the regional security officer, and the sort of bureaucratic mindset of the DS folks, and they were blown out, and then they brought in Triple Canopy. Triple Canopy was then fired, and Blackwater was given their business, and now Blackwater lost favor, and they've been sort of burned, and who knows. But the interesting thing is that when they do get rid of Blackwater, because their contract is supposed to be renewed in May, but it probably won't be, they'll just hire in place. They'll take the exact same people that Blackwater hired, hire them under a different corporate name, and get back to the same business, because the State Department can't actually function without companies like Blackwater protecting their diplomats.
Well, yeah, wouldn't that be ironic if Hillary Clinton were elected president and they renamed the company Whitewater?
Oh, yeah.
the
interesting thing is when Hillary goes to Iraq, she's guarded by Blackwater. And all this noise you hear about, all these horrible mercenaries, these terrible people, go to Baghdad International Airport and take a taxi to Baghdad. People always choose to go with Blackwater or a security company.
Right. And yet, wouldn't you say, I mean, knowing what we know and disagree, that they really did act excessively on September 16th, that there was perhaps... the actions of these Blackwater guys is kind of the fruition of some of these sort of shoot first, you know, kill them all, let God sort it out kind of attitude.
It was a perfect storm, man. What happened there, because I've talked to people, you had a situation in which a diplomat was sent to a meeting not too far from the Green Zone, and a car bomb went off outside the building. The DS guy called for backup, so another group of armored vehicles pulled up, and those two groups then left that building and called for a third group, which was a roving sort of what they call counter-assault team or CAT team. They drive armored vehicles, and they block traffic, or they provide firepower so that the diplomat can get away. They were told to block traffic in a large, very busy traffic circle. Now, you can imagine four parked vehicles in a traffic circle in the middle of the day, the kind of chaos that would create, let alone once they start shooting. This happened right outside a police station. And what happened is that there was gunfire from some point. The DS agent made the call to shoot, return fire. Shooting occurred. The police actually fired back from the Iraqi police station. There were a number of shots fired. The Little Bird helicopters came in. They have two snipers hanging off that fire saws, squad automatic weapons. And there was a bloodbath. And when the smoke cleared, instead of the State Department saying, we don't have any comment, nothing happened, you suddenly have the Iraqi government looking for a scapegoat. Because remember, we'd been beating up the Iraqi government for being a bunch of do-nothing, lazy bastards going on vacation.
Right.
They all of a sudden chose this incident, because it happened right outside a police station, as the straw that broke the camel's back. Now, they also knew that that was the soft underbelly of the State Department.
Sorry. Hang on to that thought. Let's come back to that, and because I don't want you to rush the ending, and we'll use that as a way of launching into phone calls. We'll give you all the numbers you need to join the conversation with Robert Young Pelton, License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror, and we'll see where you go with this conversation. Well, I'm sure we'll find maybe a few ex-Special Forces Blackwater guys out there listening now to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.